From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the last week, powerful earthquakes shook both Japan and Ecuador. In Japan, a 6.4 magnitude quake Thursday, followed by a 7.3 magnitude quake Saturday, killing at least 45, leaving more than 1,000 injured. In Ecuador, Saturday, a 7.8 magnitude quake rattled the country. As we go to air, at least 413 have been reported dead, 2,500 injured. We're due for some quakes of our own in this country. This hour On Point, Japan, Ecuador, and quake preparedness right here at home. People were shopping in Guayaquil, Ecuador, when Saturday's magnitude 7.8 quake hit. Joining me now from Puerto Vallejo, Ecuador, is Sarah Schaefer-Munoz, Latin America correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Sarah, welcome to On Point. Please tell us where you are in relation to the center of this quake.
Hi, Tom. I'm in Puerto Viejo, which is on the coast, which is just about 30 miles or so from the epicenter. And you're still seeing a lot of destruction here on the ground, especially in the city center.
Describe for us, if you would, what part of Ecuador this was in, the terrain of Ecuador, that this was mainly in the coastal plain. Is it a plain? What's the terrain look like? What part of the country?
Well, Ecuador is mountainous. It's an Andean country, but this is at sea level. It's along the coast. Sort of the southern coast, sort of parallel with Quito.
And overall, how widespread an area was the destruction, Sarah?
Well, the quake was felt as far away as Peru and Colombia. It was felt in Quito. It collapsed a bridge in Guayaquil, which is the city's southern port city. So it was certainly felt all over the country. And from Guayaquil north up along the coast is the area that's been hardest hit, with many of the smaller tourist cities here seeing a lot of destruction, a lot of collapsed buildings. Power is still down in most places. Water comes and goes. And there's growing shortages of food. People are waiting in line at supermarkets, although government and civil society agencies have been distributing food to people who have been left homeless by the quake.
So we're all trying to get a sense where the quake was the strongest, of how thorough the destruction is. We see the camera pictures of terrible scenes of houses and commercial buildings just in rubble. But are those one here and one there, or is that kind of destruction widespread?
It's pretty widespread. I mean, in the city of Puerto Viejo, downtown, I was there yesterday, and you see almost every single building there in, I don't know, probably a 8 or 10 block radius has been affected. They're tilted at strange angles, glass is shattered, and then in between structures that are still standing, there are just mountains of rubble with buildings, hotels, and offices that just completely collapse, spilling rubble into the streets. The wires are down, cars are crushed, street lights are tipped over. I spoke to one resident here who said, our downtown looks like Syria.
How long has it been since Ecuador had a quake of this destruction?
I think it's been at least 30 years. This is certainly the worst disaster in decades, and the worst disaster that many people here have ever seen.
What about the condition of those who have lost their homes or who are afraid to enter their homes? I'm reading in Copenhagen, the UN is loading up 15,000 sleeping mats and 18,000 repellent-soaked mosquito nets, thinking of the Zika virus. What are the conditions or the circumstances of those who've lost their homes or are afraid to enter?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure those tents, mattresses, and nets will certainly come in handy. People here are really incredible. I mean, there's definitely a sense of calm, but most people are sleeping outside, whether their homes were destroyed or whether their homes were cracked or whether a structure next to their homes, you know, looks vulnerable to collapse. Most people are outside in parks, in sort of central areas, sleeping in their own tents or sleeping on mattresses and tents provided by relief organizations. But many people are just, you know, really happy to be alive. I mean, they seem quite calm. They're just waiting. They want to wait till all the aftershocks pass. I do think there's a psychological sense that a trauma, people who went through this quake, which was incredibly, incredibly strong, just don't want to be under structures. I mean, I'm saying it a little tiny little hostel, and there was a slight tremor last night around midnight, and everybody just poured out of their rooms, set up mattresses on the patio, or just fell asleep on the patio. Nobody wanted to be inside with those aftershocks.
Sarah, could you, with a layperson's eye, see why some buildings would have fallen and others not? Were there more modern buildings that were standing, or did things seem to come down all over the place, all kinds of buildings?
You know, the destruction is really random. It's pretty amazing. You know, you, especially downtown, you walk down the street and there'll be one structure that's like tilted and cracked. And then and another one, two structures down, that's a little bit affected. And then in the middle, just a massive pile of rubble looked like it's just been almost like it's a war zone, like it was bombed. So clearly, for some reason, I don't know, but the tremors perhaps affected different areas differently, or some structures just were never built as well, or, you know, were never as stable as others.
Have you heard assessments, Sarah, for what this is likely to mean for the economy? I mean, Ecuador already suffering with low oil prices. They're an oil exporting country. Are those facilities intact? And what about their other exports, bananas and flowers and cocoa beans and fish? I mean, I've seen a lot of roads washed out here. How's the economy going to work?
There has been some damage to roads in the small city of Manta on the coast, which is near the epicenter. The port is only partially functioning. It is an important port for the country. Guayaquil is also the country's major port, and that Guayaquil is basically up and running again, back to normal.
Good.
However, this definitely presents a challenge for the administration of Rafael Correa. He's been an immensely popular president over the past decade or so, in part due to the high price of oil, Ecuador's major export. So he's spent a lot on roads, infrastructure, and healthcare. But given the collapse in oil prices, he's facing a budget crunch and the economy is starting to contract. So this really comes at a pretty bad moment for him. And I think Ecuadorians are waiting to see if this president can deliver on relief, on aid, and on rebuilding.
Sarah Schaefer Munoz headed into the epicenter of the quake zone there in Ecuador. And with us today from Portovaio, Ecuador, right in the heart of the terrain that was so hard hit. Sarah, we're very grateful to you for joining us for a few minutes here. The Wall Street Journal correspondent for Latin America there. Thank you very much, Sarah. Be safe.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Earthquakes on both sides of the Pacific. On Saturday, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe called for more troops to be sent to southern Japan, where earthquakes had hit the region. Saying here, I order a reinforcement of a great number of self-defense force troops and other disaster relief officials to the earthquake hit area. Went to full capacity there, evacuation, life-saving operations. It definitely needed that on the southwest big island there of Kyushu. Gavin Hayes joins me now from Golden, Colorado, research geophysicist at the National Earthquake Information Center at the U.S. Geological Survey. Gavin Hayes, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. My pleasure.
So do you watch the United States or do you watch the entire world when it comes to keeping track of quakes, Gavin?
We're charged with watching the entire world, Tom. While we're obviously most concerned about domestic earthquakes, we find that we can understand what might happen domestically by studying the whole planet.
So look at these two in Ecuador and Japan. First of all, are they related? We see these big maps of the ring of fire of volcanoes and tectonic volatility. Are these related or not?
No, they're not related. They're on different tectonic plates. They're thousands of kilometers apart. Earthquakes cannot communicate over those kinds of distances.
What about the scale of these quakes and the number of quakes in Japan? I mean, one and then another and lots of aftershocks as well. How would you characterize them?
The quakes are actually quite different in terms of their tectonics. The Japan quake occurred within the upper crust. It's what's known as a strike slip or a transform earthquake, where the plates or the fault moved horizontally past one another. Aftershocks will continue there. The USGS measured that earthquake as a magnitude 7. That's about 1/16 of the size of the earthquake in Ecuador, which was a magnitude 7.8. The Ecuadorian earthquake is related to what's known as subduction, where the Nazca plate, which is offshore South America, is sinking into the mantle beneath South America. And the earthquake occurred on the contact between those two massive plates.
So the Ecuadorian earthquake 16 times greater than the quake in Japan. Can you explain that? I guess it must be logarithmic here. I mean, 7 and 7.8 don't sound 16 times apart, but the higher you go, you're describing dramatically more powerful quakes.
Exactly, yeah. It's a logarithmic scale. Just to put that into perspective, there was a magnitude 9 offshore Japan in 2011 that everyone probably knows about. That's about 1,000 times bigger than the magnitude 7. The difference is where they occur in relation to people. So when an earthquake occurs close to population and very close to the surface, you see the types of intense shaking and damage that we're seeing in Japan since the earthquakes a few days ago.
We're going to really dig into each of these quakes, what they mean, and look at preparedness as well. But just sitting back, are these surprising? Are these in zones where you might have expected quakes? Or are you capable of anticipating when and where quakes may come?
We certainly can't predict earthquakes, but what we can do is study past earthquakes, study faults, study how they move, and use that to understand future hazard. So, in fact, these faults that have moved in these Japanese earthquakes were very well characterized by Japanese seismic hazard maps. They had this area as a high hazard capable of earthquakes of about this size. So it was a seismic hazard that they knew about. Similarly, in Ecuador, it's a massive plate boundary that has produced huge earthquakes in the past. In fact, this is the same subduction zone that has produced large earthquakes in Chile over the past decade, also produced the largest earthquake we've ever recorded, a magnitude 9.5 in southern Chile in 1960. So again, a hazard that we knew about and that has produced very large earthquakes in the past.
Gavin, in a word, when Americans look at these quakes, should they feel immune from quakes of this size?
Not immune, no.
Gavin Hayes, please stand by there in Golden, Colorado at the U.S. Geological Survey. We are looking at quakes, big ones, on both sides of the Pacific. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the earthquakes in Japan and Ecuador and what's going on with all the shaking going on. Preparedness here in the U.S. very much on our minds as well and beyond. Here's the sound of a rescue worker in Japan talking with CNN on Monday about the long, hard search there for survivors.
We are searching for survivors. My team is exhausted, but we're determined to find them. We'll continue to search until we find them, in whatever state.
And here on Sunday, Ecuador's Vice President Jorge Glass declared a state of emergency. Here he is urging citizens to stay calm as Ecuador dealt with the fallout of the quake.
Ante la magnitud del evento,
the vice president saying one of the strongest quakes in the last few decades here in Ecuador, a moment for unity, for calm, caution, everything activated to attend to the citizens. Gavin Hayes with us from Golden, Colorado, research geophysicist at the National Earthquake Information Center at the U.S. Geological Survey. And with us from Los Angeles, Kit Miyamoto, CEO of the structural and earthquake engineering company Miyamoto International. He also leads the nonprofit Miyamoto Global Disaster Relief, travels the world assessing earthquake risk and structural preparedness. He was in Japan after the major quake there in 2011, in which 18,000 died. I mean, it really dwarfs this in terms of death toll there. The Fukushima nuclear plant problems came out of that as well. Kit Miyamoto, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
When you look at these two quakes that we're all watching right now in Japan and Ecuador, just look at these through a split screen for a moment here and what you're thinking as you look at the structures, you look at the destruction, you look at the aftermath. What does it leave you thinking about the quakes and about the local readiness in advance?
Well, I mean, these outcomes, I guess, are totally expected. Example of the Ecuador, the area is fairly remote from our capital, and those buildings are made of older concrete structures, mm-hmm. and that's actually really dangerous buildings. Any concrete buildings built, say, prior to 1980s, what we call non-ductile concrete structures, which means essentially really brittle buildings. Mm-hmm. And so if the strong motion hits like that, they're crumbling like what you just saw up there. And also the new constructions too. Even a new building you design today in, say, L.A. or San Francisco, it may survive through the earthquake. It may protect the life, but that's it. And so the buildings may not be usable or even not repairable. You're going to see major damages. You're going to see some deaths there even. So that's how the building code is set up.
Kit, what about in Japan? I mean, Japan has had very high earthquake experience and awareness for a long time. Mm-hmm. I assume their building codes take that into account. And yet, I mean, of course, you saw there in Kumamoto in Kyushu, the island province, the old castle wall there tumbling into the moat. You had a suspension bridge coming down. We've seen temples, beautiful temples that have collapsed. And we've got 100,000 plus evacuees from their homes, presumably because they fear those homes. Even with the stronger building codes, are they still up against acute risk?
That's right, exactly. Even if you designed and built for the best codes available, essentially it is for the reduction of death and injury. So it's a reduction of risk. So therefore, there would be damage. There could be quite a bit of damage on the buildings. So you'll not be able to use those buildings after the fact. And it's true in the U.S. also. But there is actually a way to make it better. Usually spending about 2 to maybe 5% of the total construction cost, you can make those buildings resilient. And that is the way to go forward, actually.
I want to say right here that for anyone listening and who's seen these images and hearing about the destruction today, if you want to help in Japan and Ecuador, you can link to ways to do that at our website, onpointradio.org. Many people have that response, and it's a beautiful thing, and I hope you will. Gavin Hayes, can you take us back to you were describing how these two were structurally different types of quakes, and can you take us deeper into that and then bring us back to the surface and help us think about how these different types of quakes may produce different kinds of damage to human structures and habitat?
Yeah, Tom, I can do my best. Both earthquakes occurred in what we call convergent margins, where plates are colliding. In Japan, the Philippine sea plate is moving to the west and subducting beneath Japan, that is, sinking into the mantle beneath Japan, colliding with Eurasia. That process also generates, as well as the large fault at depth on which those earthquakes can occur, it creates a lot of contraction in the upper crust along the islands of Japan. That creates many faults along which earthquakes can occur, and these earthquakes we saw over the weekend are an expression of that. So they're related to that broad-scale convergence, but they occurred on a smaller fault very shallow in the crust.
Okay.
In Ecuador, we also have two plates colliding. As I said, the Nazca plate collides with South America. That generates the uplift of the Andes. The earthquake there actually occurred on the contact between those two plates at depth, though, around 20 or so kilometers at depth, just beneath the coastline of Ecuador. And that is a larger fault capable of much larger earthquakes. Because it's a little further away from population centers, the way that those buildings shake will be a little different than what they experienced in Japan.
And so play those then out on the surface. Which type produces what kind of destruction? Or does it really matter once they get going? If things are shaking, they're shaking.
A lot of things need to be taken into account. One of them is distance away from the earthquake. One of them is how big the earthquake is. How big the earthquake is affects how long the shaking will occur. How far away it is affects the period of shaking that those buildings will experience, the frequency of that shaking. So because the Japanese earthquake was closer to the surface and closer to some of those population centers, they likely felt some more intense, higher frequency shaking. But, you know, the 7.8 earthquake in Ecuador was also very big and very close to some population centers. So when you're in that earthquake, it feels very intense regardless.
Kit Miyamoto, as an earthquake engineer, which of these types of earthquakes, you know, deep or surface action, is more concerning to you when it comes to destruction?
Oh, I don't like both of them. It's the, for example, the New Zealand and Christchurch earthquake in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
That was only magnitude 6.3, but it was very close to surface, like about 1 kilometer, right at the Christchurch. So destroyed almost 1,800 to 2,000 buildings out of 2,400 building stocks in Christchurch.
Wow.
Killed about 200 people.
Yeah.
So it was shallow and very high-frequency earthquake, but destroyed many. And Nepal earthquake in last year, 2015, it was magnitude 7.8. It was a subduction zone like the That's what happened in Ecuador.
Yes.
And it was a much longer period, especially in Kathmandu. And so it actually destroyed many high-rise buildings because the longer the period or the slower the motion would be, affect the taller buildings. So actually smaller buildings in Kathmandu didn't feel any earthquake at all even, but tall one felt a lot. So it just depends on what, well, I guess I don't like both of them because of that.
Yeah, I mean, Gavin, you know, just yesterday we got the news that Catherine Schultz with the New Yorker magazine had won a Pulitzer for her really compelling story. Maybe people, some people read it last summer, headlined the really big one. And looking at the still coming giant quake likely to hit the northwest of the United States, we've heard forever about the San Andreas Fault, but she's looking up at the Cascadia subduction zone, talking about just terrible destruction there. Which of these quakes was more like, structurally, what the west coast of the U.S. could face at some point?
The northwest coast of the U.S. could experience earthquakes very similar to both, to be honest. The subduction zone hazard that was written about in that story was very comparable to what we saw in Ecuador. That subduction zone can generate very large earthquakes, up to probably about magnitude 9. We think in the year 1700, there was a magnitude 9 on that subduction zone. And obviously associated with earthquakes that big, we have tsunamis, which can be very destructive, as we saw in 2011 in Japan. There are also upper plate faults above that subduction zone in the very shallow crust that, while earthquakes occur much less frequently, can have the types of earthquakes that we saw in Japan. So there are both types of hazards there. The one that people are probably more aware of and the one that can generate the larger earthquakes is the subduction zone hazard comparable to Ecuador.
Kid, I wonder, when we look back in history, and you go way back, famously Lisbon in 1755, 40,000 dead. Japan in 1923, and some people blame the political changes and even the militarization of Japan on the terrible aftermath of this. 1923, 140,000 dead. Sumatra in 2004, 170,000 people dead. And then you look, of course, at the Tangshan earthquake in China, 1976, 750,000 dead. Just astonishing numbers. Are there still parts of the world that are vulnerable to that kind of death toll in a quake circumstance, Kit?
Oh, most definitely. Even the last year Nepal earthquake, it collapsed almost 600,000 structures and damaged 7,000 school buildings or collapsed. We only lost, unfortunately, we lost 10,000 people. But that happened Saturday noon. If the earthquake happened, say, Friday or Monday, I bet you we lost like a million people. We probably lost 100,000 of students. So just the timing actually makes a huge difference. And this particular earthquake in Ecuador happened in a weekend also. And I know many schools have been damaged and collapsed. And if that happened on weekdays, that would be a totally different story. Actually, schools are one of the most dangerous building types out there, even in California, too. So that's something we really need to look into that.
Thank God it was a weekend when students were not in those schoolrooms in Nepal. Kit Miyamoto saying could have been maybe a million dead. Well, who knows? But it was far, far shy of that. And thank heavens. Kit Miyamoto, Gavin Hayes, please stand by. Callers for the two of you. Mike in Appleton, Wisconsin. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, Tom. Hi.
Hi.
Calling from a very stable Wisconsin.
Good for you today.
I lived many years overseas in different parts of the world. I've encountered tornadoes and hurricanes and cyclones. But 30 of those years were spent in the Andean countries, in Bolivia, Peru, Chile, and Ecuador. And I went through, frankly, countless numbers of earthquakes. Just from on the ground and from a human perspective, there is nothing like an earthquake, because a tornado or a storm or a hurricane or whatever, it's something that you can actually, you know, hear about, see coming. You know it's going to hit you.
Mm-hmm.
An earthquake just happens, and it catches you totally unaware, and it's just absolutely terrifying. And one kind of low-tech early warning system is sometimes your household pets.
Yeah.
Because I've noticed over the years, we always had a dog. The dog would always know when there was an earthquake coming. He would start to act weird. He would start to howl. I guess they can sense it or they can hear it.
Maybe they just feel it coming before you do. But I know what you mean, Mike. Having spent a bunch of years in Japan, suddenly it's just happening. And you have no idea how long it's going to go on and how much destruction it may do. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here. Catherine, Jeffersonville, Vermont. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
I survived the and lived through the 1971 earthquake in February out in the San Fernando Valley, Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm.
In California. And looking back at that, it was at like a 6.5, 6.7 earthquake. And I know somewhere around 145 people were killed at that time. But I had just turned 12. It was the day after my birthday. And through the eyes of a child, I remember seeing just buildings collapsed, going past the VA hospital that had collapsed, knowing that a local officer had been killed on an overpass, just waking up to this incredible roar and shaking. We were right in the middle in Northridge. Our house stood, but some of our neighbors didn't. We were supposed to evacuate because of the fears of a dam breaking. We didn't. I remember at the time my father felt that staying in a vacation travel trailer that we had on our property was fine.
Yeah.
But just the whole, from that point on and that introduction to my first earthquake and living out there, I'm on the East Coast now for 10 years, but always being told that you need to note your exits anytime you walk into a building, having earthquake supplies in your car, raising your children that way, it's a way of life. Knowing, you know, and in California, in our community, we joke about earthquake weather, something which is not true. It's been proven not to be scientifically, but just the whole idea of looking at what these people are now suffering through in these recent earthquakes in Japan and Ecuador. And it just brings back those memories, and I truly feel for the children, and just everything, this aftermath that they're going through.
Absolutely. It's so disorienting when suddenly everything is shaken and many things come down. I mean, Ecuador, we had a prison wall fell down, 180 prisoners ran out of there at the El Rodeo prison. Japan, you've got a 670-foot suspension bridge just plunging into a valley that... Beautiful tempo near Mount Aso there. Beautiful, beautiful old temple just collapsed on the ground. Kit Miyamoto, in the United States, are we making that 2 to 5% investment you're talking about that would make buildings survive?
Yeah, actually, you can make the building much more resilient than the so-called fallen minimum building code.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and...
Are we doing it?
No, really. I mean, it's starting somewhat in California for some of the critical buildings, but we're definitely a long way. I mean, I think there's some sort of a false sense of security here in especially in California. So yeah, we went through the 1989 San Francisco, 1995, the Northridge and all that, and my building survived. But these buildings are, I mean, these earthquakes are really, you know, kind of moderate earthquake in a sense. We haven't really seen yet the true major urban disaster since 1906.
Hold the thought if you would, Kit Miyamoto with Miyamoto International Earthquake Engineering Company and Gavin Hayes at the U.S. Geological Survey. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the earthquakes of Japan and Ecuador and what's up with all the shaking going on. Preparedness in the U.S. very much on our minds as well. Kit Miyamoto is with us. He's CEO of the structural and earthquake engineering company Miyamoto International. Also heads up the nonprofit Miyamoto Global Disaster Relief. And by the way, if you want to contribute for the folks in Ecuador or Japan, you can find links to ways to do that at our website, onpointradio.org. Gavin Hayes is with us from Golden, Colorado, research geophysicist at the National Earthquake Information Center at the U.S. Geological Survey. And here we are. You can join us as well. What do you think? Is it crazy that we keep living and building on these fault lines, or do we just have to live our lives? Rich in Trumbull, Connecticut, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I have a question for your guest.
Mm-hmm.
Does the extraction of oil from rock have an effect on the magnitude of a quake. I mean, we all know that the coefficient of friction will change if you add oil to or between surfaces. And some wells go deep, and some wells are probably a little shallower in the mantle. So does that have an effect on it?
You're thinking about lubing up all that underground rock and seeing what, Gavin Hayes, what about it? We've heard a lot about oil drilling, fracking, and more in Oklahoma and the quakes there. What about the broader question from Rich?
I mean, broadly, yes, industrial activity can have an effect on earthquakes. We're seeing that in Oklahoma, where the reinjection of wastewater material is probably related to much of the seismicity there over the past 5 years or more. I don't think we can specifically lube up faults to make them release their energy or anything like that. That's not something that fits within the governing laws of earthquakes. But certainly industrial activity can have an effect on earthquakes, yes.
And do you see, I mean, the question there is kind of could they encourage earthquakes in an unhappy way if you're doing oil drilling? And beyond that, do you see beyond Oklahoma the effect of specifically of fracking as having wider earthquake consequences?
That's something certainly that regulators, I think, are worried about, whether human activity can induce earthquakes in places where we might expect larger earthquakes like California. And that's why some of the regulations perhaps need to be a little stricter. Go ahead.
Yeah, fine. I want to put to you, Kit, we look back on these numbers from the past, 750,000 in China in 1976 dead. They seem so shocking, but the global population has grown a lot since then, population density and urban sprawl, and it's supposed to grow even more. Does that necessarily mean more people at risk?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, there are a lot more dangerous places becoming more dangerous because becoming higher risk. I mean, hazard always stays the same. There is always earthquake hazard always. That exists. But the risk get higher because of more people, more building, higher building, bigger buildings and built. So risk get much bigger today. So yes, in our lifetime, we're going to see the million people death in by the earthquake. You're going to see that. And so that's the something we're facing, and but we can do something about it today, you know? That's kind of always frustrates me.
Is that million dead in a single quake, are you picturing that abroad somewhere or here in the States or either?
It'll be abroad. It'll be, a place like some parts of India, some parts of South Asia, Central Asia. I mean, there are, you know, even China, there's some certain areas highly populated and it's very exposed. And a lot of dangerous buildings, and that's the really problem. And come to the United States, you're not going to see the hundreds of thousands of people death here. You're going to see the probably thousands of people dying, as I can see that. But also the impact to the economy will be tremendous. Not only the because of buildings or bridges damaged, but also the we lose businesses, we lose jobs, and it's just going to be a huge chaos. And, you know, I've been living pretty much disaster zone for the past 10 years, from Japan to Haiti to New Zealand to Kathmandu. And I think here in the U.S., we have slightest idea what is a really urban disaster really look like. And because last one we had in West Coast in 1906, we never seen anything like that here in the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, we are very unprepared for that. But slowly but surely, we're doing some stuff. And here in LA, the school district is still looking at their older schools for seismic strengthening. And that kind of activity is extremely important, just kind of by little by little, you know. Yep. And LA passed the ordinance for the what we call soft story buildings. They are really dangerous building types. And they started having their seismic strengthening with a program like that. So there's definitely, I think, public sector have to do certain things. And also private sector, commercial owners have to do certain things. And then providing a higher resilient buildings with a higher, say, star ratings, per se, that makes, I think, commercially really makes sense. Not only it's going to save lives down the road.
I mean, there are immediate effects. Here's a listener online writes, Blue Jay, we had a quake at our prison. All the guards ran outside while the inmates were screaming, what about us? One officer replied, you're on your own. There's a lot of immediate drama, but big scale drama as well. Economic, as you say, Kit Miyamoto, also political. I mean, people look back to the big quake in Caracas, Venezuela, 1812, and Simon Bolivar, and then his whole movement to liberate South America from Spanish rule. There are political aftershocks very often from really big quakes as well. Lena in Putney, Vermont. Lena, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I have a question about the Cascadian fault line. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, so I have a bit of the unhealthy denial that you have to live with.
And this is the Pacific Northwest, the Cascadia, yeah.
Yeah. When that article went viral, the New Yorker article, happened to be around the time we were looking to relocate to Oregon. And what I, and then the, there was a quote in it that says, you know, they had a FEMA said something like, you know, everything west of I-5 corridor will be toast. And when the second article followed up by that, they talked about the buildings and the roads and a lot of the coastal towns. So we actually, after speaking to somebody who was supposed to lead FEMA in our area, and he confirmed that the school buildings, the town hall, there were buildings made of concrete, as you mentioned, that will just crumble. So there is a, the Oregon is prepared in the way that they have a network, but they're not prepared in the way of spending any funds on building and on retrofitting these buildings. What I was told, in fact, if I was interested in moving there, to be aware that some of the buildings will collapse and to make sure that our single-framed house structure foundation. So as a result, we didn't relocate. So I, and I know of a few other people who didn't relocate to the area. So there's an economic impact in terms of growth. But also, where is the level of accountability, understanding there's a subduction zone, in fact, isolating it to Coos Bay, knowing what could be destroyed, and there's not really any funds. Is this something voters vote on? Is this something that money just has to be spent? How do we then make those steps?
Lena, let me hold that thought for just a moment. We're going to talk with Lucy Jones for a minute, the earthquake lady out of California who's thought a lot about that. Gavin, while I've got you, I just want, and while holding Lena's question there, could you just take us on a quick tour across the U.S. in terms of major areas of vulnerability of earthquake risk?
Certainly, yes. Obviously, we know about the West Coast, the San Andreas Fault through California, the Cascadia subduction zone in the Pacific Northwest that we've been talking about. Broadly, the basin and range through eastern California, Nevada, Utah, can generate earthquakes as well. The USGS has just released some seismic hazard maps for the Wasatch Front in Salt Lake City that highlights the earthquake hazard there. We know about an earthquake history in the central and eastern U.S. as well. The New Madrid seismic zone near St. Louis has generated large earthquakes in the past and might be capable of generating similarly sized earthquakes in the future. And parts of South Carolina as well have had large earthquakes in the past and could be capable of such events again in the future. So the USGS makes seismic hazard maps for these purposes. They're on our website, and you can find them there.
And what about up through the on into the Northeast as well, risk there?
The Northeast has a lower seismic hazard risk. There is potential for earthquakes in the 4 to 5 to maybe as high as 6 range. Not what we're seeing on the West Coast, but still enough that it can shake buildings and scare people, certainly.
Gavin Hayes, you're very generous to be with us today, and we appreciate it. Research geophysicist at the National Earthquake Information Center at the U.S. Geological Survey with us from Colorado. Thank you very much, Gavin.
My pleasure.
And Kit Miyamoto at Miyamoto International Earthquake Engineering, also Miyamoto Global Disaster Relief. Kit Miyamoto, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
I want to turn right now to California, no stranger to earthquakes, and Lucy Jones, seismologist, often called, many know her as the earthquake lady. She recently retired after 33 years at the U.S. Geological Survey. She's now at Caltech, visiting research associate there. She has been the one who's come forward after many, many tremors and quakes to talk with the public about what's going on. We wanted to get her perspective today. Lucy Jones, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Are you being pulled out of a peaceful retirement by these latest quakes in Ecuador and Japan?
Yes, it isn't quite sitting down writing my book that I thought I was going to be doing.
I appreciate your coming out. I mean, one question on the table is from one of our callers just now. You worked in this arena for so long. You've been right here before describing the destruction risks in California and beyond, how acute they remain in many ways. But what's the best way for getting political buy-in to preparation for these likely disasters that everybody agrees are coming?
Well, they all agree you're coming is relatively new, and that is the first step.
Okay.
It's a very important step. You have to say this really is a problem. You have to be realistic about how this problem that happens once every few centuries in the Pacific Northwest or once a century in California compared to the other, you know, people are dying right now because of being homeless, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be aware and work within that the framework. You've got to admit that they spend money. They're going to cost money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I worked with Mayor Garcetti of Los Angeles for a year, and the outcome is the biggest change in seismic safety we've ever seen. And I've tried to understand what happened. A chunk of it was a political leader with the will to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very important piece. The other piece was being able to be concrete about what the risk is. You know, a FEMA director waving his arm and saying everything west of I-5 is toast doesn't give you planning documents. And in fact, the response people often over-exaggerate what it's going to be because they're trying to plan for the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Being realistic is very important. So I led a project in the survey where we actually worked out exactly what a big urban earthquake would be. As Kit said, we don't have the experience, but science can give it to us. We worked it through. We said, okay, $213 billion, 6 months without water, 1,600 fires that double the losses. And then you can lay out and go, okay, the damage to our water system seems to be the most critical issue. And we now have the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power undertaking a major effort to try and upgrade the system. Faced with the reality, it's billions of dollars, and nobody wants to give DWP more money.
Yeah.
So it's still a lot of political work to be done, but I think being concrete about what the losses will be, and that's what science does for us, and then getting the policy people and the science people talking together closely and understanding each other. It can't happen quickly. It's a long process.
This is On Point. I mean, Kit Miyamoto made the point, and I think you've spoken about this as well, that you did a lot of work on building codes in California, and those codes should keep a lot of buildings or up to code from collapsing. But you said for a little bit more, another couple of percent,
right,
they could go from not collapsing to being usable, because not collapsing means maybe the death toll is much lower, but the economic destruction has been very much on your mind, and that we haven't built code to guard against.
Exactly. And, you know, part of it is because why are we so afraid of earthquakes? It is that fear of dying, and it's a dreadful death, and it evokes all of those fears. And the human beings are much more willing to do response than actual prevention. And so as we've gone through this process, many in the engineering community just believe, you know, they talk with developers and, oh, no, they're not willing to pay that extra money. So part of it's been a communication problem. But I think watching what's happened in Christchurch, New Zealand, since their earthquake 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
you know, only 185 people died. Two buildings had partial collapse. The building code did what it was supposed to. They've had to tear down 1,800 buildings.
Wow.
They've economic devastation, a lot of people dying, increased medical problems.
And that was 1,800 after my guest Kit Miyamoto said out of 2,400. I mean, that's a huge portion of the town had to be torn down.
They lost their damn town. And they basically, the downtown area is completely gone and being rebuilt. They have enough insurance to do that. If they have a second claim like this, they won't get insurance again. And it's still disruptive. The families moved away because it was just too awful being there. So the economic destruction they're seeing is horrific. If you now scale that up that's a city of 450,000.
Mm-hmm.
This Southern California is 20 million people. Let's do the same thing to that with our San Andreas earthquake. We are going to cause as many deaths from the economic disruption as we do in the earthquake. And it shouldn't be acceptable. But a lot of it has been this communication issue. People don't understand. Most elected officials did not realize that when they were voting for the code, they were voting for crawl out alive. And so,
yeah, and that's all. And that's crawl out alive.
That's all.
And yet, Lucy, here we are. I mean, you're not the front person anymore on this, but you're still in California. You got half a minute. Philosophically, how do you justify that to yourself? You're there. You live there in the middle of it.
Because it's only 1 to 2. Oh, how do I justify living in California?
Well, just living with the risk of, how do you think philosophically about the risk of the quake?
Because the risk to my life from an earthquake is far, far less than my risk of being murdered, let alone dying on the freeway. So if a rational assessment of the risk says it's not a risk to my life, the financial risk, I can do what I can individually. I always get I buy a house, I get a foundation specialist to check it out and make it stronger. And the regional economy is a bigger issue, and I think that's why, as I come towards the later part of my career, I'm moving out of federal service to be able to advocate for a better, more rational approach to the economic problems.
Lucy Jones, you've always been great on this. We're glad you're still working on it. We hope you get people's minds wrapped around that in this week when we're all thinking about Japan and Ecuador. Thank you so much for being with us today, Lucy.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Lucy Jones, now at the Seismological Laboratory at Caltech. This is On Point.